From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
America is just as much a colonial power as England ever was. America is just as much a colonial power as France ever was. In fact, America is more so a colonial power than they, because she's a hypocritical colonial power behind it.
40 years ago today, Malcolm X was assassinated. Today, the undiscovered Malcolm will be joined by scholar Manning Marable, working on a major biography of Malcolm X.
Malcolm X is a figure that millions of Americans believe they know quite well, but there is a hidden history to Malcolm X. The three chapters from the autobiography of Malcolm X that are missing. The unresolved issues regarding his 1965 assassination.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Iraq, more than 90 people have died over the past 3 days in a string of attacks striking Shiite targets. On Saturday, as Shiites celebrated Shura, the holiest day of the year, 8 suicide bombers struck, 55 died, and scores more were injured. Saturday marked the deadliest day since last month's elections. On Ashura, Shiites mark the 7th century death of the Prophet Muhammad's grandson, Hussein. In other news from Iraq, Time magazine is reporting secret talks have begun between U.S. officials and members of the Sunni resistance. The Bush administration has publicly rejected such negotiations, but Time magazine says back-channel talks have already occurred with resistance fighters, though none aligned with the suspected al-Qaeda militant Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. In news on Iran, President Bush has publicly pledged to support Israel if it decides to preemptively attack Iran. During a news conference on Thursday, Bush was asked how concerned he is that Israel might attack Iran's nuclear sites.
And in that Israel is our ally, and in that we've made a very strong commitment to support Israel. We will support Israel if her security is threatened.
In news from Israel, Prime Minister Ariel Sharon's cabinet has approved evacuating all the Israeli settlements inside Gaza. Sunday's 17-5 vote marks the first time an Israeli government has ever okayed the removal of settlements in the West Bank or Gaza. Sharon described the pullout as the most difficult decision of his 60-year career, but he said, quote, "It's vital for the future of the state of Israel." Sharon has defended the move by arguing Israel should focus on solidifying its grip on West Bank settlements in exchange for evacuating the harder-to-defend settlements in Gaza. The cabinet also voted Sunday to approve rerouting the 400-mile separation wall in the West Bank. Last year, the Israeli Supreme Court criticized the wall's path, forcing the rerouting. Under the new plan, about 8% of the West Bank will be enclosed on the Israeli side of the wall, essentially making that land off-limits to Palestinians. Analysts say the timing of the two votes appeared aimed at blunting international criticism over the separation wall. Last year, the International Court of Justice at The Hague ruled the entire wall illegal because it hinders Palestinians' freedom of movement and was tantamount to annexation by Israel. But Israel's dismissed the ruling, saying the international court lacks jurisdiction. On Sunday, the Secretary General of the Palestinian Cabinet, Hassan Abu Lebda, said the chance for peace would be, quote, unavailable if Israel continues building the wall in the West Bank. Meanwhile, Israel released 500 Palestinian prisoners today and announced plans to release 400 more within the next 3 months. And the Israeli government has also ordered the military to stop demolishing the family homes of Palestinian suicide bombers. According to the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem, the Israeli military had destroyed over 670 homes for this reason over the past 4 years. Israel made the decision after the government concluded the demolitions were fueling resistance to the Israeli occupation. Overall, B'Tselem estimated Israel's destroyed up to 5,000 Palestinian homes over the last 4 years, the majority during military operations. In St. Louis, hundreds of delegates from peace groups around the country gathered over the weekend for the second National Assembly of the United for Peace and Justice. It was the first major gathering of peace organizations since the November election. Groups included Black Voices for Peace, Military Families Speak Out, and Women for Peace. In news from Washington, the Republican chair of a Senate Environmental Committee has been accused of intimidating critics of President Bush's proposed Clear Skies environmental initiative. 2 weeks ago, two national organizations openly criticized the measure. In response, Republican Senator James Inhofe has directed the two organizations to turn over their financial and tax records for the past 6 years, as well as provide a list of members. The groups are the State and Territorial Air Pollution Program Administrators and the Association of Local Air Pollution Control Officials. Both groups represent state and local agencies that deal with monitoring air pollution. Republicans have defended the request, claiming they need to know whether the groups are secretly being subsidized by any outside interests, such as environmentalists or foundations. Critics of the so-called Clear Skies Initiative say the legislation is too lenient on polluters and would undermine the abilities of individual states to protect air quality. Democratic Congressmember Henry Waxman of California said, quote, "This is a blatant attempt at intimidation and bullying so that experts will be afraid to speak out about a bill that rolls back air pollution protections for all Americans." In other news from Washington, a Food and Drug Administration advisory panel has voted to allow doctors to keep prescribing the popular painkillers Vioxx, Celebrex, and Bextra, even though the panel overwhelmingly agreed the drugs significantly increase the risk of cardiovascular problems in patients. The panel proposed that the drugs be sold with an FDA black box warning. Vioxx is now expected to return to the market, even though nearly half the FDA panel voted against it being sold. Its manufacturer, Merck, voluntarily withdrew the painkiller drug in the fall. The FDA panel decides whether a drug should be allowed to be sold on a straight majority vote. The vote for Vioxx was 17-15 for Bextra. 17 panelists voted for the drug, 13 voted to ban it. The panel nearly unanimously recommended Celebrex remaining available. Last year, FDA whistleblower Dr. David Graham publicly estimated that 139,000 Americans who took Vioxx suffered serious side effects. Of these users, he estimates the drug killed between 26,000 and 55,000 people. Dr. Sid Wolf of Public Citizen says the FDA's decision defies common sense. Public Citizen has warned if Merck starts selling Vioxx again, that the watchdog group would immediately petition the government to have it taken off the market. A former aide to the first President Bush has released a series of secretly recorded audio tapes of the current President Bush speaking privately in 98. On one tape recorded by Doug Weed, Bush suggests he once smoked marijuana and vowed not to answer questions by reporters on the issue. He said, quote, "I wouldn't answer the marijuana questions. You know why? Because I don't want some little kid doing what I tried." Part of the tapes also suggest Bush may have used cocaine, an allegation that surfaced before. When asked about cocaine, Bush replied, quote, "I haven't denied anything." On another tape, Bush states John Ashcroft would make a, quote, "very good Supreme Court pick," or, quote, "fabulous vice president." And Bush also privately criticized Bill Clinton and Al Gore in much harsher terms than he did publicly. Bush said Clinton, quote, "disgraced the nation." He described Gore as a pathological liar. The tapes were released by Doug Weed, who said he made the tapes because he believed the president was a historic figure. Weed is the author of two books on presidential history and a former Assembly of God evangelist. In Brazil, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva has signed decrees setting aside 8 million acres to create two massive new rainforest reserves. The decree was signed 1 week after the American-born nun and environmental activist Dorothy Stang was murdered in the Amazon, where she'd worked for decades to preserve the land. And author and journalist Hunter S. Thompson has died at the age of 67. Police say Thompson shot himself on Sunday night at his home in Woody Creek, Colorado. He became one of the country's best-known young journalists in the late 60s and early 70s while working for Rolling Stone, where his drug-induced books Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas and Fear and Loathing on the Campaign Trail were first serialized. Thompson once said, quote, "I hate to advocate weird chemicals, alcohol, violence, or insanity to anyone, but they've always worked for me." Thompson identified the death of the American dream as his reporter's beat. He called his style of writing gonzo journalism. He once said, quote, "Objective journalism is one of the main reasons American politics has been allowed to be so corrupt for so long." In 1994, he wrote an obituary for President Nixon in Rolling Stone and titled it, quote, "Notes on the Passing of an American Monster." While covering Nixon's 1972 reelection campaign, Thompson wrote, quote, "It's Nixon himself who represents that dark, venal, and incurably violent side of the American character almost every other country in the world has learned to fear and despise." Coltrane's Spiritual, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. 40 years ago today, February 21st, 1965, Malcolm X was shot dead as he spoke at the Audubon Ballroom in Harlem. He'd just taken the stage when shots rang out, riddling his body with bullets. Malcolm X was 39 years old. At his funeral, the actor and civil rights activist Ozzie Davis hailed Malcolm as, quote, "Our black shining prince." Today, commemorations are scheduled across the country. In New York, the historic Abyssinian Baptist Church is hosting a national commemoration of Malcolm X with Percy Sutton, Sonia Sanchez, Haki Madhubuti, Dr. James Turner, Gil Noble, Reverend Herbert Daughtry, and one of Dead Prez. Later this year, the Audubon Ballroom is scheduled to reopen as the Malcolm X and Dr. Betty Shabazz Memorial and Education Center. The center is officially scheduled to open on May on what would have been Malcolm's 80th birthday. Meanwhile, Columbia University professor Manning Marable is working on a major new biography of Malcolm X. Professor Marable has spent already 10 years researching the book. It's tentatively titled Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention. Today, Professor Marable joins us in our Firehouse studios to spend the hour to discuss the legacy of Malcolm X as well as some of his new findings. Professor Marable has said, quote, Malcolm X was potentially a new type of world leader, personally drawn up from the wretched of the earth into a political stratosphere of international power. And telling that remarkable true story is the purpose of my biography. Professor Marable's research has raised new questions about the autobiography of Malcolm X, which was written with Alex Haley. Marable has also examined unredacted FBI files, which provide new insight into the role of the FBI and New York Police Department in the assassination of Malcolm X. We'll be joined by Professor Marable in just a moment, but first we begin with Malcolm X himself, and words recorded just a month before he was assassinated. It was January 65. He gave this speech entitled Prospects for Freedom.
When this country here was first being founded, there were 13 colonies. The whites were colonized. They were fed up with this taxation without representation. So some of them stood up and said, liberty or death. Though I went to a white school over here in Mason, Michigan, the white man made the mistake of letting me read his history books. He made the mistake of teaching me that Patrick Henry was a patriot and George Washington wasn't nothing nonviolent about old Pat or George Washington. Liberty or death was what brought about the freedom of whites in this country from the English. They didn't care about the odds. Why, they faced the wrath of the entire British Empire. And in those days, they used to say that the British Empire was so vast and so powerful when the sun would never set on it. This is how big it was. Yet these 13 little scrawny states, tired of taxation without representation, tired of being exploited and oppressed and degraded, told that big British Empire, liberty or death. And here you have 22 million Afro-Americans, black people today, catching more hell than Patrick Henry ever saw. And I'm here to tell you, in case you don't know it, that you got a new generation of black people in this country who don't care anything whatsoever about odds. They don't want to hear you, old Uncle Tom, handkerchief heads, talking about the odds. No. This is a new generation. If they're going to draft these young black men and send them over to Korea or South Vietnam to face 800 million Chinese, if you're not afraid of those odds, you shouldn't be afraid of these odds.
Malcolm X, a month before he was assassinated, it was January 1965 at a speech he gave in New York, sponsored by the Militant Labor Forum. This is Democracy Now! We're joined by Professor Manning Marable, one of America's most influential and widely read scholars, professor of history and African-American studies at Columbia University, founding director of the Institute for Research in African-American Studies, again working on a new biography of Malcolm X. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you. It's always great to be here.
It's great to be with you. Why don't you summarize for us? I mean, you have been studying Malcolm X for more than a decade now.
That's right.
What you think are the most explosive findings. And then throughout the hour, we will tease them out and talk about them.
I think that Malcolm X was the most remarkable historical figure produced by Black America in the 20th century. That's a heavy statement, but I think that in his 39 short years of life, Malcolm came to symbolize Black urban America, its culture, its politics, its militancy, its outrage against structural racism. And at the end of his life, a broad internationalist vision of emancipatory power, far better than any other single individual, that he shared with Du Bois and Paul Robeson, a Pan-Africanist internationalist perspective. He shared with Marcus Garvey a commitment to building strong Black institutions. He shared with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. a commitment to peace and the freedom of racialized minorities. He was the first prominent American to attack and to criticize the U.S. role in Southeast Asia. And he came out four square against the Vietnam War in 1964, long before the vast majority of Americans did. So that Malcolm X represents the cutting edge of a kind of critique of globalization in the 21st century. And in fact, Malcolm, if anything, was far ahead of the curve in so many ways.
We're going to break, and then when we come back, we're going to talk about the autobiography of Malcolm X, the missing chapters and where they are, which you've got a chance to see excerpts of.
That's right.
We're going to talk about how the autobiography was written and the FBI, their relationship with Alex Haley. We will talk about these things and more in just a minute. Archie Shepp, Malcolm, Semper Malcolm, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 300 stations around the country, on Pacifica stations and affiliates, on NPR stations, public access TV stations, as well as PBS stations. And we're on both satellite TV networks, Dish Network Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, as well as on DirecTV, Channel 375, and we're video and audio streaming at democracynow.org. And for people who are deaf or hard of hearing, we close caption. I'm Amy Goodman as we spend the hour today on Malcolm X, today the 40th anniversary of his assassination. Our guest is Columbia University professor Manning Marable, writing a biography of Malcolm X, and also the editor of the magazine Souls, a critical journal of Black politics, culture, and society. The winter 2005 issue photograph of Malcolm X on the cover, and that's what the whole issue is devoted to, with a major article by Professor Marable. Let's talk about the autobiography of Malcolm X.
Okay. The most people who read the autobiography perceive the narrative as a story that now millions of people know. And it was, it's a story of human transformation, the powerful epiphany, Malcolm's journey to Mecca, his renunciation of the Nation of Islam's racial separatism, his embrace of universal humanity, of humanism that was articulated through Sunni Islam. Well, that's the story everybody knows, but there's a hidden history. You see, Malcolm and Haley collaborated to produce a magnificent narrative about the life of Malcolm X, but the two men had very different motives in coming together. What Malcolm did not know is that back in 1962, a collaborator of Alex Haley, a journalist named Alfred Balk, had approached the FBI regarding an article that he and Haley were writing together for the Saturday Evening Post. And the FBI had an interest in castigating the Nation of Islam and isolating it from the mainstream of Negro civil rights activity. And so consequently, a deal was struck between Balk, Haley, and the FBI, that the FBI provided information to Balk and Haley in the construction of their article, and Balk was really the interlocutor between the FBI and the two writers in putting a spin on the article. The FBI was very happy with the article they produced, which was entitled The Black Merchants of Hate, came out in early 63. What's significant about that piece is that that became the template for what evolved into the basic narrative structure of the autobiography of Malcolm X.
Did Alex Haley know about this relationship?
There is no direct evidence that Haley sat down with the FBI. Nevertheless, since Balk was the co-author of the piece, and it was Balk who talked directly with the FBI,
did Haley
one
know?
Can assume that Haley was involved in it.
And did Haley at least talk to Balk about, did he know about Balk's relationship with the FBI?
One can assume that Haley did, because Haley and Balk co-authored the piece, traveled throughout the United States together, and collected material together to form an article that they co-authored. It would be highly unlikely that Haley did not know.
Mm-hmm. Then the writing of the autobiography, Alex Haley and Malcolm X's relationship. How did they do it?
Over a period of...
And why did Malcolm X choose him?
Over a period of about a year and a half, Malcolm and Haley agreed to work with each other. They met usually after a long business day that Malcolm put in. Very tired, he'd get there at about either at Haley's apartment, or they would meet at then Idlewild Airport at a hotel, and Malcolm would be debriefed by Haley. He would talk. Haley would take notes. Malcolm had a habit of scribbling notes in small pieces of paper that Haley would surreptitiously pick up at the end of their discussions. Malcolm's objective was actually to re-ingratiate himself within the Nation of Islam, that because he had emerged by the early 60s as a very prominent figure outside of the NOI, there were critics within the organization that were saying to the patriarch of the NOI, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, that Malcolm planned to take over the organization, which was not true. But nevertheless, Malcolm felt that if he could make a prominent public statement to show his fidelity to the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, that might win him back in the good graces of the organization. But there were internal critics, sharp critics, who were very opposed to him, and who were very, and some of them were members of Elijah Muhammad's family, such as Herbert Muhammad, Raymond Sharif, who was the head of the Fruit of Islam, the brother-in-law of the son-in-law of Elijah Muhammad, they isolated Malcolm X, kept him out of the newspaper of the organization, Muhammad Speaks, for over a year, which is kind of curious. He was the national spokesperson of the NOI, and he wasn't represented in their own newspaper for over a year. Haley's objective was quite different. Haley was a Republican. He was an integrationist. He was very opposed to black nationalism. His objective was to illustrate that the racial separatism of the NOI was a kind of pathological or a kind of, it was the logical culmination of separatism and racial isolationism and exclusion. He wanted to show the negative aspects of the NOI's ideology, Yacoub's history, and all of the ramifications of racial separatism that he felt were negative. And that Malcolm, being as charismatic as he was, a very attractive figure nevertheless, he embodied these kinds of negative traits. Haley felt that he could make a solid case in favor of racial integration by showing what was, to white America, what was the consequence of their support for racial separatism that would end up producing a kind of hate, the hate that hate produced, to use the phrase that Mike Wallace used in his 1959 documentary on the Nation of Islam. And so the two men, for very different reasons, came together. What is striking is that from the very beginning, certainly by September and October of 1963, as the book was being constructed, that Haley was vetting, asking questions to the publisher and to the publisher's attorney regarding many of the things that Malcolm was saying. He was worried that he would not have a book that would have the kind of sting that he wanted. He was also concerned, to use Haley's phrase, about the purported anti-Semitism of Malcolm X. And so he began to rewrite words or passages in the book without Malcolm's knowledge. And Haley, in his own, this is prior to emails, Haley had a tendency to write even more frequently and voluminously to his agents and his editors than he did putting pen to paper in his own books. So that one finds in Haley's archives, or the archives of Anne Romaine, who was going to be his biographer until her tragic death in 1995, one finds a copious a series of notes from Haley to his editors and attorneys regarding the construction of the autobiography itself. He wanted to steer the book to accomplish his political goals as well as Malcolm's goals.
Now, Professor Marable, you went to the Haley collection.
That's right.
Can you talk about that experience and how difficult it is really to get original information about Malcolm X, and the Haley example is just one?
That's right. One of the striking things about doing research on Malcolm X, and I believe that most Malcolm X researchers could tell you their own stories, is that there's this paradox of the absence of critical information. Malcolm X is a person who has inspired, he's been the muse of several generations of black cultural workers, artists, poets, playwrights. There are literally 1,000 works with the title Malcolm X in them. There are over 350 films and over 320 web-based educational resources with the title Malcolm X, yet the vast majority of them are based on secondary literatures, that is, not on primary source material. In the case of Alex Haley, Haley's material is located at the University of Tennessee at Knoxville primarily, but there are a whole series of elaborate steps that one has to encounter in order to even begin to do research. There's an attorney, you have to, if you want to photocopy material from that archive, you have to get permission from the attorney beforehand. You have to name the exact pages you want to photocopy before you can photocopy them. So that there are a whole series of steps. You can only use a pencil rather than a pen to copy down material, et cetera. It's a laborious process, and it takes a long time just to do a small amount of research. Fortunately, Anne Romaine, who was appointed by Haley just before his death to be his own biographer.
She was a folk singer?
That's right, a folk singer and a skillful historian, even though she was not formally trained in the field. She collected her own parallel archive to Haley, and without Anne Romaine's archive, which is also at the University of Tennessee, let me put it in a positive light. With that archive, we've gained of extensive knowledge about how Haley and Malcolm actually worked and how the book, the autobiography, was constructed. The raw material for Chapter 16, a lot of that material, is actually in Romaine's archives, not in Haley's, which is interesting. That's right. But what is most interesting about the book is that, as I've read it over the years, Something was odd to me. It's like, you know, Malcolm broke with the NOI in March 1964, and in that last 11 chaotic months, he spent most of the time outside of the United States. Nevertheless, he built two organizations in the spring of 1964. First, Muslim Mosque Incorporated, which was a religious organization that was largely based on members of the NOI who left with him. It was spearheaded by James 67X, or James Shabazz, who was his chief of staff. And then secondly was the Organization of Afro-American Unity. This was an organization that was a secular group. It largely consisted of people that we would later call, several years later, black powerites, black nationalists, progressives, coming out of the black freedom struggle, the Northern Students Movement, students, young people, professionals, workers, who were dedicated to black activism and militancy, but outside of the context of Islam. There were tensions between these two organizations, and Malcolm had to negotiate between them, and since he was out of the country a great deal of the time, it was rather difficult for him to do so. It seemed rather odd that there's only a fleeting reference to the OAAU inside of the book that's supposed to be his political testament. And I wondered about this, and it seemed like something was missing. Well, as a matter of fact, there is three chapters. And those three chapters really represent a kind of political testament that are outlined by Malcolm X. And to make a long story short, they're in a safe of a Detroit attorney by the name of Greg Reed. He purchased these chapters in a sale of the Haley estate in late 1992 for the sum of $100,000. And since that time, no historian, or at least I suppose I'm the exception, very few people have actually had a chance to see the raw material that was going to comprise these three chapters, the missing political testament that should have been in the autobiography but isn't.
And what is he doing with them?
Well, they're sitting in his safe. And I guess the conundrum, and I'm not an attorney or a person who does intellectual property, but my understanding of the situation is that he owns the property, but he owns the physical texts of these chapters, but Mr. Reed does not own the intellectual property, the content of these chapters, so he can't publish them.
Is this the same attorney, Reed, who is involved with perhaps a lawsuit to do with Rosa Parks?
That's right. It's the same one with the trial with the hip-hop group that's based in Atlanta. And Gregory Reed
is... This is Outkast?
That's right, with Outkast. And in fact, I was even... I think even Reed sent something to me asking me to be a to give testimony in this trial, which I promptly said thanks, but no thanks.
It's because Outkast used in their music, they use Rosa Parks' words, her own voice.
And that's right.
And how does the family of Rosa Parks feel about this?
Well, I can't really say. I just know what I've seen on the media. I know that they weren't very happy about this.
Happy about?
About Greg Reed's representation, but...
So he's not representing them.
Well, again, I can't really characterize what is going on with that lawsuit because I'm not really a party to it.
Now, you are the only historian who've seen excerpts of the attorney Reed, the three chapters that he has in his safe?
I can't say that for
certain.
One
of the few.
I could say that very few people have seen it. Reed, after a series of conversations, Reed said he would allow me to see this. This was about 2 years ago. I flew out to Detroit. I asked, when could I come over to the office? And he said, no, let's meet at a restaurant, which struck me as rather odd. We met at a restaurant. He came with a briefcase, and he opened the briefcase, and he showed me the manuscripts, and he said, I'll let you take a look at this for about 15 minutes. Well, that wasn't very much time, and I was deeply disappointed. Nevertheless, in that 15-minute time, looking at the content, because I am so familiar with what Malcolm wrote at certain stages of his own life and development, it became very clear that there is a high probability he wrote this material sometime between August or September 63 to about January 64. Now, this is a critical moment in his development. In November 63, he gives his famous Message to the Grassroots address in Detroit, which really kind of marks off the real turning point in his own development. But I would argue that equally important is a brilliant address he gives in Harlem in mid-August of 1963, which actually is one of my favorite addresses by Malcolm, which actually is superior, in my judgment, to the Message to the Grassroots address, where he lays into a critique of what then is being mobilized, the March on Washington, D.C., the pinnacle of the civil rights movement. Malcolm envisions a broad-based, pluralistic united front, which is spearheaded by the Nation of Islam, but mobilizing integrationist organizations, non-political organizations, civic groups, all under the banner of building black empowerment, human dignity, economic development, political mobilization. He's already envisioning the NOI playing a role cooperatively with integrationist organizations. I believe that if we could see the chapters that are missing from the book, we would gain an understanding as to why perhaps, the FBI, the CIA, the New York Police Department, and others in law enforcement greatly feared what Malcolm X was about because he was trying to build a broad, an unprecedented black coalition across the lines of black nationalism and integration. And in a way, it presages 30 years ahead of time, the Million Man March.
Professor Maribel, we have to break. When we come back, we'll ask more about those chapters and also about the assassination of Malcolm X 40 years ago today. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
From the Indians, welcome the pilgrims, and to the buffaloes who once ruled the plain. Like the vultures circling beneath the dark clouds, looking for the rain. Looking for the rain.
like the cities that stagger on the coastline. And a nation that just can't stand much more. Like the forest buried beneath the highway, never had a chance to grow.
Gil Scott-Heron, Winter in America, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Our guest is Professor Manning Marable of Columbia University, and long time now writing the biography of Malcolm X, which I see has just been bought by a publisher and is going to be coming out in a few years.
That's right, with Viking Penguin. That's right.
More on these three chapters, what you saw in the restaurant, and then let's talk about the assassination of Malcolm X.
I think that Malcolm was envisioning, even while he was in the Nation of Islam, a black nationalist progressive strategy toward uniting black people across ideological, class lines, denominational, religious lines, Christians, as well as Muslims, to build a strong movement for justice and for empowerment. And I think that that is what frightened the FBI, and that is what frightened the CIA. That is what they had to stop. And if one thinks about it, those of the listeners and our viewers who know the history of COINTELPRO, the counterintelligence program of the FBI that occurred in the 1960s and 70s, that in 1965 or 6, that J. Edgar Hoover wrote an infamous memo called the Black Messiah Memo. He said, we must stop the rise of a black messiah. That was the concern that the FBI had more than anything else. Either Malcolm or Martin could have played the role of a unifier. But it was Malcolm, as long as he remained within the Nation of Islam, talking to the converted, he did not represent a fundamental threat to the American government. But when he began to talk about uniting the very fractious civil rights movement, when he began to negotiate with people like A. Philip Randolph and Bayard Rustin and Martin and others, keep in mind that several weeks before Malcolm's assassination, he went to Selma, Alabama. Dr. King was imprisoned during the mobilization, and he went to Mrs. King, and he told Coretta that, you know, that even though we're very different people, that we're really about the business of the same struggle. We just use different tactics, and I want you to understand, and I want you to convey to your husband that I deeply respect what he's doing. So Malcolm had a clear vision and an understanding that he was a part of a broad freedom struggle. As his vision became more internationalist and pan-African, as he began, especially in 64, after seeing the example of anti-colonial revolutions abroad and began to articulate and incorporate a socialist analysis economically into his program, he clearly became a threat to the U.S. state.
And explain how events led to this day, 40 years ago, the assassination of Malcolm X.
I believe that the evidence will show that there was not so much a conspiracy, but a convergence of interests with three different groups that had an interest in eliminating his voice and his vision. The first group, obviously, is the NYPD, the New York Police Department. They had their own Red Squad, which was called BOSS, the Bureau of Special Services. And they had managed to infiltrate Malcolm's organization and the Nation of Islam, and of course the FBI. There were over 40-some thousand pages of FBI documents, of which only about half are currently available to scholars and researchers. I think that this 40th anniversary of the assassination is a good opportunity for us to say that now is the time to declassify all FBI material on Malcolm X. And there really is a need for us to challenge the U.S. government for its refusal to open up its own archives 40 years after the death of Malcolm All of that material should be made available to all researchers and all scholars and to the family of Malcolm X. So that I believe that the FBI clearly was concerned, wanted to monitor and disrupt Malcolm wherever possible. Gene Roberts, one of Malcolm's chiefs of security, was NYPD undercover cop. He later went on to bigger things by being a disruptive force inside of the Black Panther Party. So that's one element. A second element was the Nation of Islam. Linwood X, who was one of the leaders of the New Jersey mosques of the Nation of Islam, was at the Audubon Ballroom sitting on the first row. He came in early to observe the events on the 21st of February. He was taken aside by Benjamin 2X, close associate of Malcolm, and also Reuben X Francis, who was the chief of security. Linwood said he just wanted to check out what Malcolm had to say. But my sense is that perhaps his role was more complicated than simply that of a bystander. We know from Talmadge Hare, one of the men who carried out the assassination, who was shot by Reuben X as he tried to flee the Audubon after shooting Malcolm X. We know that Hare confessed years later to his imam in prison that there had been a walkthrough a week prior to February 21st at the Audubon Ballroom. So there was deep knowledge on the part of members of the Nation of Islam regarding the planning inside of the OAAU and the Muslim Mosque Incorporated regarding the events at the Audubon. They knew when they were going to be there. They knew what the schedules were. How did they know this? Well, in part because they had informants inside of the organization, and in part because, obviously, they had information that hardly anybody else had. They also knew something else, clearly, that on the day of the assassination, and here we get to the third group, I think the third group are elements within Malcolm's own entourage. Elements within Malcolm's own entourage, some of them were very angry with some of the changes that had occurred with Malcolm. One source of anger, curiously enough, was the tension between MMI and OAAU. That the MMI, the Muslim Mosque Incorporated, these were women and men who had left the Nation of Islam out of loyalty to Malcolm, but then Malcolm continued to evolve rapidly. He never renounced and never stepped away from a strong commitment to Black nationalism and Black self-determination. That's absolutely clear if you do any analysis of his speeches. But what is clear is that he incorporated within the framework of Black nationalism a Pan-Africanist and internationalist perspective. And in doing so, he began to reassess radically earlier positions of sexism and patriarchy. He began to break with notions of sexism that he had long held as a member of the Nation of Islam, and began to advance and push forward women leadership in the OAAU. MMI brothers were very resistant to women such as Lynn Shiflett and others who emerged as leaders within the OAAU. And so one of the tensions that occurred was around gender equality and gender leadership inside of Malcolm's entourage.
And then that day, there was the presence or lack of presence of the NYPD.
And that's right. The NYPD was ubiquitous. They were always around Malcolm. Whenever Malcolm spoke, there would be one or two dozen cops all over the place. On this day, the cops were nowhere to be seen. The cops later explained that they had been pulled off the Audubon in order to go across the street. Normally, they were in a command center on the second floor adjacent to the large ballroom in the building. On this day, there were only two cops at the moment of the shooting inside of the building, but they were as far away as possible from the site of the ballroom. The man who actually apprehended Talmadge Hare, the only shooter who was shot at the site, Thomas Hoy was actually driving by accident. So clearly they had been pulled off the case.
He was an off-duty cop.
That's right. Why would the cops disappear quite literally? Then there were other kinds of curious things. There was a complete failure of protection of the principal. The MMI brothers who provided security for Malcolm had been trained by Malcolm himself that inside of the Nation of Islam, whenever there is a diversion, you protect the principal. The principal, in this case, Malcolm, clearly was not protected in this on February the 21st. First off, nobody was checked for weapons as they came in. Now, of course, people know that over the last several months prior to February 21st, 1965, the OAAU and MMI tried to get away from the old practices of checking people at the door for weapons. They wanted people to feel more comfortable. But the guards themselves did not carry weapons. Now, Malcolm's home had just been firebombed a week before, and the guards didn't carry weapons. Malcolm had insisted that the guards not carry firearms that day. I've asked James Shabazz, I've asked other people who are members of the OAAU, Herman Ferguson and others, what led to that disastrous decision. James Shabazz said to me with a shrug, you know, you just didn't know Malcolm. Malcolm was adamant, and that whatever Malcolm wanted, that's what we just did. But I said, this is highly irresponsible, considering that there were death threats that were constant, that there was FBI surveillance and disruption, and that none of you carried weapons. Well, that's not quite true, because we later learned that from unredacted FBI files that we've discovered and that we have archived in the municipal archives here in the city of New York, that there were at least, according to the district attorney, at least three undercover cops who were at the ballroom that day. We know one of their names. We know that...
What's his name?
Well, we know that Gene Roberts, who is depicted giving mouth-to-mouth resuscitation to Malcolm
we
after
only
he's
have
been
a
shot,
minute.
Was an undercover cop. But who were the others? Two of the three men who were imprisoned, Norman Butler and Robert 15X Johnson, and convicted and given life sentences, I'm absolutely convinced were innocent. The real murderers of Malcolm X have not been caught or punished. I think that now is the moment for us to rededicate ourselves to learning the truth about what happened on February the 21st. And the place to begin is to make all evidence public. And we have to begin with the federal government and the FBI.
Dr. Manning Marable, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Professor Marable is writing a biography of Malcolm X that will come out in a few years as a major piece in his magazine, Souls, a critical journal of black politics, culture, and society. And tonight we'll be at Columbia University talking more about his investigation. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That does it for Democracy Now! If you want transcript or more information, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Jeremy Scahill. Ryan Abernathy is our engineer today. Again, our website is democracynow.org. Also to sign up for Headlines, our daily digest, as well as media alerts. Today's special email to friends around the country. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.